Welcome to the Horror Babble Podcast. The Door to Saturn by Clark Ashton Smith. 1. When Morgi, the high priest of the goddess Yanda, together with 12 of his most ferocious and efficient underlings, came at morning twilight to seek the infamous heretic Ibon in his house of black gneiss on a headland above the northern main, they were surprised, as well as disappointed, to find him absent. Their surprise was due to the fact that they had every intention of taking him unawares, for all their plots against Ibon had been carried on with meticulous privacy, in underground vaults with soundproof bolted doors, and they themselves had made the long journey to his house in a single night, immediately following the hour of his condemnation. They were disappointed because the formidable writ of arrest, with symbolic flame-etched runes on a scroll of human skin, was now useless, and because there seemed to be no early prospect of trying out the ingenious agonies, the intricately harrowing ordeals which they had devised for Ibon with such care. Morgi was especially disappointed, and the malisons which he muttered when the emptiness of the topmost room had revealed itself were of truly cabalistic length and fearfulness. Ibon was his chief rival in wizardry, and was acquiring altogether too much fame and prestige among the peoples of Mu Thulan, that ultimate peninsula of the Hyperborean continent. So Morgi had been glad to believe certain malignant rumours concerning Ibon, and to utilise them in the charges he had preferred. These rumours were that Ibon was a devotee of the long-discredited heathen god Xothaquah, whose worship was incalculably older than man, and that Ibon's magic was drawn from his unlawful affiliation with this dark deity, who had come down by way of other worlds from a foreign universe, in primeval times when the earth was still no more than a steaming morass. The power of Xothaquah was still feared, and it was said that those who were willing to forego their humanity by serving him would become the heritors of anti-mundane secrets, and the masters of a knowledge so awful that it could only have been brought from outlying planets coeval with night and chaos. The house of Ibon was built in the form of a pentagonal tower, and possessed 5 stories, including the 2 that were underground. All, of course, had been searched with painstaking thoroughness, and the 3 servants of Ibon had been tortured with a slow drip of boiling hot asphaltum to make them reveal their master's whereabouts. Their continued denial of all knowledge after a half hour of this was taken as proof that they were genuinely ignorant. No sign of a subterranean passage was unearthed by delving in the walls and floor of the lower rooms, though Morgi had even gone so far as to remove the flagstones beneath an obscene image of Xothaquah, which occupied the nethermost. This he had done with extreme reluctance, for the squat, fur-covered god, with his bat-like features and sloth-like body, was fearsomely abhorrent to the high priest of the elk goddess Yanda. Returning in renewed search to the highest room of Ibon's tower, the inquisitors were compelled to own themselves baffled. There was nothing to be found but a few articles of furniture, some antique volumes on conjuration such as might be owned by any sorcerer, some disagreeable and gruesome paintings on rolls of pterodactyl parchment, and certain primitive urns and sculptures and totem poles of the sort that Ibon had been so fond of collecting. Xothaquah, in one form or another, was represented in most of these, his face even leered with a bestial somnolence from the urn handles, and he was to be found in half the totems, which were those of subhuman tribes, along with the seal, the mammoth, the giant tiger, and the aurochs. Morgi felt that the charges against Ibon were now substantiated beyond all remaining doubt, for surely no one who was not a worshipper of Xothaquah would care to own even a single representation of this loathsome entity. However, such additional evidence of guilt, no matter how significant or damnatory, was of small help in finding Ibon. staring from the windows of the topmost chamber, where the walls fell sheer to the cliff, and the cliff dropped clear on two sides to a raging sea 400 feet below. Morki was driven to credit his rival with superior resources of magic. Otherwise, the man's disappearance was altogether too much of a mystery, and Morki had no love for mysteries, unless they were part of his own stock in trade. He turned from the window and re-examined the room with minutely careful attention. Ibon had manifestly used it as a sort of study. There was a writing table of ivory, with reed pens and various coloured inks in little earthen pots, and there were sheets of paper made from a kind of calamite, all scribbled over with odd astronomical and astrological calculations that caused Morgi to frown because he could not understand them. On each of the five walls there hung one of the parchment paintings, all of which seemed to be the work of some aboriginal race. Their themes were blasphemous and repellent, and Zothaqua figured in all of them, amid forms and landscapes whose abnormality and sheer uncouthness may have been due to the half-developed technique of the primitive artists. Morgi now tore them from the walls, one by one, as if he suspected that Ibon might in some manner be concealed behind them. The walls were now entirely bare, and Morgi considered them for a long time, amid the respectful silence of his underlings. A queer panel, high up in the southeastern side above the writing table, had been revealed by the removal of one of the paintings. Morgi's heavy brows met in a long black bar as he eyed this panel. It was conspicuously different from the rest of the wall, being an oval-shaped inlay of some reddish metal that was neither gold nor copper, a metal that displayed an obscure and fleeting fluorescence of rare colours when one peered at it through half-shut eyelids. But somehow it was impossible, with open eyes, even to remember the colours of this fluorescence. Morgi, who perhaps was cleverer and more perspicacious than Ibon had given him credit for being, conceived a suspicion that was apparently baseless and absurd, since the wall containing the panel was the outer wall of the building, and could give only on the sky and sea. He climbed upon the writing table and struck the panel with his fist. The sensations which he felt, and the result of the blow, were alike astounding. A sense of icy cold, so extreme that it was hardly distinguishable from extreme heat, ran along his hand and arm and through his whole body as he smote the unknown reddish metal. And the panel itself swung easily outward, as if on unseen hinges, with a high, sonorous clang that seemed to fall from an incomputable distance. Beyond it, Morgi saw that there was neither sky nor sea nor, in fact, anything he had ever seen or heard of, or had even dreamed of in his most outrageous nightmares. He turned to his companions. The look on his face was half amazement, half triumph. "Wait here till I return," he commanded, and leaped headlong through the open panel. The charges that had been brought against Ibon were indeed true. The sagacious wizard, in his lifelong study of laws and agencies, both natural and supernatural, had taken account of the myths that were prevalent in Muthulan regarding Zothaqua, and had thought it conceivably worthwhile to make a personal investigation of this obscure pre-human entity. He had cultivated the acquaintance of Zothaqua, who, in the desuetude of his worship, was now driven to lead an existence wholly subterranean. He had offered the prescribed prayers, had made the sacrifices that were most acceptable, and the strange, sleepy little god, in return for Ibon's interest and his devotion, had confided to him certain information that was more than useful in the practice of the black arts. Also, he had presented Ibon with some autobiographical data that confirmed the popular legends in more explicit detail. For reasons which he did not specify, he had come to Earth in former eons from the planet Cycronosh, the name by which Saturn was called in Muthulan, and Cycronosh itself had been merely a way station in his travels from remoter worlds and systems. As a special reward, After years of service and burnt offerings, he presented to Wyborn a large, thin, oval plate of some ultra-telluric metal, instructing him to have it fitted as a hinged panel in an upper room of his house. The panel, if swung outward from the wall on open air, would have the peculiar property of giving admittance to the world Psychronosh, many million miles away in space. According to the vague and somewhat unsatisfactory explanation vouchsafed by the god, this panel, being partly wrought from a kind of matter which belonged to another universe than man's, possessed uncommon radiative properties that served to ally it with some higher dimension of space, through which the distance to astronomically remote spheres was a mere step. Zothakwa, however, warned Ibon not to make use of the panel, unless in time of extreme need, as a means of escape from otherwise inevitable danger, for it would be difficult, if not impossible, to return to Earth from Psychronosh, a world where Ibon might find it anything but easy to acclimate himself, since the conditions of life were very different from those in Mu-Thulan, even though they did not involve so total an inversion of all terrene standards and norms as that which prevailed in the more outlying planets. Some of Zothakwa's relatives were still resident in Psychronosh, and were worshipped by its peoples, and Zothakwa told Ibon the almost unpronounceable name of the most powerful of these deities, saying that it would be useful to him as a sort of password if he should ever need to visit Psychronosh. The idea of a panel that would open on some remote world impressed Ibon as being rather fantastic, not to say far-fetched, but he had found Zothakwa to be in all ways and at all times a most voracious deity. However, he made no trial of the panel's unique virtues, till Zothakwa, who maintained a close surveillance of all underground doings, had warned him of the machinations of Morgi and the processes of ecclesiastic law that were being instituted in the vaults below the temple of Yanda. Knowing as he did the power of these jealous bigots, Ibon decided that it would be injudicious to the point of folly if he were to let himself fall into their hands. Bidding a short and grateful farewell to Zothakwa, and collecting a small parcel of bread and meat and wine, he retired to his study and climbed upon the writing table. Then, lifting aside the crude picture of a scene in Psychronosh with which Zothakwa had inspired some primeval half-human artist, he pushed open the panel it had served to conceal. Ibon saw that Zothakwa was indeed a god of his word, for the scene beyond the panel was nothing that could ever find a legitimate place in the topography of Mu-Thulan, or of any terrestrial region. It did not altogether appeal to him, but there was no alternative save the inquisitorial cells of the goddess Yanda. Envisaging in thought the various refinements and complications of torture which Morgi would have now prepared, he sprang through the opening into Psychronosh with an agility that was quite juvenile for a wizard of mature years. It was only a step, but turning, he saw that all trace of the panel or of his dwelling had now disappeared. He was standing on a long declivity of ashen soil, down which a sluggish stream that was not water but some liquescent metal resembling mercury ran from tremendous unscalable shoulders and horns of the mountain heights above, to debouch in a hill-surrounded lake of the same liquid. The slope beneath him was lined with rows of peculiar objects, and he could not make up his mind whether they were trees, mineral forms, or animal organisms, since they appeared to combine certain characteristics of all these. This preternatural landscape was appallingly distinct in every detail, under a greenish-black sky that was overarched from end to end with a triple cyclopean ring of dazzling luminosity. The air was cold, and Ibon did not care for its sulphurescent odor, or the odd puckery sensation it left in his nostrils and lungs. And when he took a few steps on the unattractive-looking soil, he found that it had the disconcerting friability of ashes that have dried once more after being wetted with rain. he started down the slope, half fearing that some of the equivocal objects around him would reach out their mineral boughs or arms to arrest his progress. They seemed to be a kind of bluish-purple obsidian cacti, with limbs that ended in formidable talon-like spines, and heads that were altogether too elaborate for either fruits or blossoms. They did not move as he passed among them, but he heard a faint and singular tinkling with many modulations of tone that preceded and followed him along the slope. Ibon conceived the uncomfortable notion that they were holding converse with each other, and were perhaps debating what should be done with him, or about him. However, he reached without mishap or hindrance the end of the declivity, where terraces and ledges of decomposing trap, like a mighty stairway of elder eons, had rimmed the sunken lake of liquescent metal. Wondering as to the way he should now take, Ibon stood irresolute on one of the ledges. His train of conjecture was broken by a shadow that fell suddenly athwart him and lay like a monstrous blot on the crumbling stone at his feet. He was not prepossessed by the shadow. It was outrageously defiant of all known aesthetic standards, and its malformation and distortion were no less than extravagant. He turned to see what manner of creature had flung the shadow. This being, he perceived, was not easy to classify. With its ludicrously short legs, its exceedingly elongated arms, and its round, sleepy-looking head that was pendulous from a spherical body, as if it were turning a somnambulistic somersault. But after he had studied it a while and had noted its furriness and somnolent expression, he began to see a vague, though inverted likeness to the god Zothaqua, and remembering how Zothaqua had said that the form assumed by himself on Earth was not altogether that which he had worn in Cycronosh, Ibon now wondered if this entity was not one of Zothaqua's relatives. He was trying to recall the almost inarticulable name that had been confided to him by the god as a sort of password, when the owner of that unusual shadow, without seeming to note Ibon's presence, began a descent of the terraces and ledges toward the lake. Its locomotion was mainly on its hands, for the absurd legs were not half long enough for the steps it had to take. Arriving at the lake edge, the creature drank of the fluid metal in a hearty and copious manner that served to convince Ibon of its godship, for surely no being of an inferior biologic order would quench its thirst with a beverage so extraordinary. Then, reascending to the ledge where Ibon stood, it paused and appeared to notice him, for the first time. Ibon had finally remembered the outlandish name for which he was groping. Zeal Quoig Munzar, he sought to articulate. Doubtless the result was not wholly comfortable to Cycronosian rules, but Ibon did the best he could with the vocal organs at his command. His auditor seemed to recognize the word, for it peered at Ibon a little less sleepily than before, with its inversely situated eyes, and even deigned to utter something which sounded like an attempt to correct his pronunciation. Ibon wondered how he was ever to learn such a language, or, having learned it, how he was ever to pronounce it. However, it heartened him a little to find that he was understood at all. "Zothaqua," he said, repeating the name three times in his most orotund incantatory manner. The topsy-turvy being opened its eyes a trifle more, and again admonished him, uttering the word Zothaqua with an indescribable abbreviation of vowels and thickening of consonants. Then it stood regarding him for a while, as if in doubt or cogitation. Finally, it raised one of its ell-long arms from the ground and pointed along the shore, where the mouth of a low valley was discernible among the hills. It said distinctly the enigmatic words, "Iqui Dlosh Odklonk." And then, while the sorcerer was pondering the significance of this unusual locution, it turned away from him and started to reascend the higher steps, toward a rather spacious cavern with columned opening, that he had not heretofore perceived. It had hardly passed from sight into the cavern, when Ibon was greeted by the High Priest Morgi, who had readily followed him by his tracks in the ashen soil.
"Detestable sorcerer! Abominable heretic! I arrest you!"
said Morgi with pontifical severity. Ibon was surprised, not to say startled, but it reassured him to see that Morgi was alone. He drew the sword of highly tempered bronze which he carried, and smiled. "I should advise you to moderate your language, Morgi," he admonished. "Also, your idea of arresting me is slightly out of place now, since we're alone together in Sycronosh, and Muthulan and the temple cells of Yanda are many million miles away." Morgi did not appear to relish this information. He scowled and muttered,
"I suppose this is some more of your damnable wizardry."
Ibon chose to ignore the insinuation. "I have been conversing with one of the gods of Sycronosh," he said magniloquently. "The god, whose name is Zeal-Quoig Munzar, has given me a mission to perform, a message to deliver, and has indicated the direction in which I should go. I suggest that you lay aside our little mundane disagreement and accompany me. Of course we could slit each other's throats or eviscerate each other, since we are both armed. But under the circumstances, I think you will see the puerility, not to mention the sheer inutility, of such a proceeding. If we both live, we may be of mutual use and assistance in a strange world whose problems and difficulties, if I mistake not, are worthy of our united powers." Morgi frowned and pondered.
"Very well," he said grudgingly. "I consent. But I warn you that matters will have to take their course when we return to Muthulan."
"That," rejoined Ibon, "is a contingency which need not trouble either of us. Shall we start?" The two Hyperboreans had been following a defile that wound away from the lake of fluid metal, among hills whose vegetation thickened and grew more various as their height decreased. It was the valley that had been indicated to the sorcerer by the topsy-turvy biped. Morgi, a natural inquisitor in all senses, was plying Ibon with questions.
"Who or what was the singular entity that disappeared in a cavern just before I accosted you?"
"That was the god Zeal-Quoig Munzar."
"And who, pray, is this god? I confess that I have never heard of him."
"He is the paternal uncle of Zothaqua." Morgi was silent, except for a queer sound that might have been either an interrupted sneeze or an exclamation of disgust. But after a while, he asked,
"And what is this mission of yours?"
"That will be revealed in due time," answered Ibon, with sententious dignity. "I am not allowed to discuss it at present. I have a message from the god which I must deliver only to the proper persons." Morgi was unwillingly impressed.
"Well, I suppose you know what you're doing and where you're going. Can you give me any hint as to our destination?"
"That, too, will be revealed in due time." The hills were lapsing gently to a well-wooded plain, whose flora would have been the despair of earthly botanists. Beyond the last hill, Ibon and Morgi came to a narrow road that began abruptly and stretched away in the distance. Ibon took the road without hesitation. Indeed, there was little else to do, for the thickets of mineral plants and trees were rapidly becoming impenetrable. They lined the way with serrate branches that were like sheaves of darts and daggers, of sword blades and needles. Ibon and Morgi soon noticed that the road was full of large footprints, all of them circular in form, and rimmed about with the marks of protruding claws. However, they did not communicate their misgivings to each other. After an hour or two of progress along the yielding ashy thoroughfare, amid the vegetation that was more horrent than ever with knives and caltrops, the travellers began to remember that they were hungry. Morgi, in his haste to arrest Ibon, had not breakfasted, and Ibon, in his natural hurry to evade Morgi, had committed a like omission. They halted by the wayside, and the sorcerer shared his parcel of food and wine with the priest. They ate and drank with frugality, however, since the supply was limited, and the landscape about them was not likely to yield any viands that were suitable for human sustenance. With strength and courage revived by this little refection, they continued their journey. They had not gone far when they overtook a remarkable monster that was plainly the originator of the numerous footprints. It was squatting down with its armored haunches toward the travelers, filling the whole road for an indeterminable distance ahead. They could see that it was possessed of a myriad short legs, but they could form no idea of what its head and forequarters were like. Ibon and Morgi were much dismayed.
"Is this another of your gods?" asked Morgi ironically.
The sorcerer did not reply, but he realized that he had a reputation to sustain. He went boldly forward and cried out, "Zeal Quoig Manzar!" in the most resonant bellow that he could summon. At the same time, he drew his sword and thrust it between two plates of the horny mail that covered the monster's hindquarters. Greatly to his relief, the animal began to move and resumed its march along the road. The Hyperboreans followed it, and whenever the creature slackened its pace, Ibon would repeat the formula which he had found so effective. Morgi was compelled to regard him with a certain awe. They travelled on in this manner for several hours. The great luminous triple ring still overarched the zenith, but a strangely small and chilly sun had now intersected the ring and was declining toward the west of Cycronosh. The forest along the way was still a high wall of sharp metallic foliage, but other roads and paths and byways were now branching off from the one that the monster followed. All was very silent, except for the many-footed shuffling of this uncouth animal, and neither Ibon nor Morgi had spoken for miles. The High Priest was regretting more and more his rashness in pursuing Ibon through the panel, and Ibon was wishing that Zothakwa had given him the entree to a different sort of world. They were startled out of their meditations by a sudden clamour of deep and booming voices that rose from somewhere in advance of the monster. It was a veritable pandemonium of unhuman guttural bellowings and croakings, with notes that were somehow suggestive of reproof and objurgation, like shrewish drums, as if the monster were being scolded by a group of unimaginable entities.
"Well?" queried Morgi.
"All that we are destined to behold will reveal itself at the proper time," said Ibon. The forest was thinning rapidly, and the clamour of termagant bellows was drawing closer. Still following the hindquarters of their multipedal guide, which was crawling on with reluctant slowness, the travellers emerged in an open space and beheld a most singular tableau. The monster, which was plainly of a tame and harmless and stupid sort, was cowering before a knot of beings no larger than men, who were armed only with long-handled goads. These beings, though they were bipeds and were not quite so unheard of in their anatomic structure as the entity which Ibon had met by the lake, were nevertheless sufficiently unusual, for their heads and bodies were apparently combined in one, and their ears, eyes, nostrils, mouths, and certain other organs of doubtful use were all arranged in a somewhat unconventional grouping on their chests and abdomens. They were wholly naked, and were rather dark in colour, with no trace of hair on any part of their bodies. Behind them, at a little distance, were many edifices of a kind which hardly conformed to human ideas of architectural symmetry. Ibon strode valorously forward, with Morgi following discreetly. The torso-headed beings ceased their scolding of the fawning monster, and peered at the earthmen with expressions that were difficult to read on account of the odd and baffling relationship of their features. "Zeal Quoig Manzar, Zothakwa," said Ibon with oracular solemnity and sonority. Then, after a pause of hieratic length, "Iquit losh od clonk." The result was indeed gratifying, and was all that could be expected even from a formula so remarkable, for the Cycranossian beings dropped their goads and bowed before the sorcerer, till their featured bosoms almost touched the ground. I have performed the mission. I have delivered the message given me by Zeelkwoig Munzar, said Ibon to Morgi. Two. For several Cycranossian months, the two Hyperboreans were the honored guests of this quaint and worthy and virtuous people, who called themselves the Blemfroims. Ibon had a real gift for languages, and made progress in the local tongue far more readily than Morgi. His knowledge of the customs, manners, ideas and beliefs of the Blemfroim soon became extensive, but he found it a source of disillusionment as well as of illumination. The armored monster that he and Morgi had driven before them so valiantly was, he learned, a domestic beast of burden that had strayed away from its owners amid the mineral vegetation of the desert lands adjoining Vlor, the chief town of the Blemfroims. The genuflections with which Ibon and Morgi had been greeted were only an expression of gratitude for the safe return of this beast, and were not, as Ibon had thought, an acknowledgment of the divine names he had quoted, and the fearsome phrase Iqui de Losh Odklonk. The being that Ibon had met by the lake was indeed the god Zeelkwoig Munzar, and there were dim traditions of Zothaquar in certain early myths of the Blemfroims. But this people, it seemed, were most regrettably materialistic, and had long ceased to offer sacrifice and prayer to the gods, though they spoke of them with a sort of distant respect, and with no actual blasphemy. Ibon learned that the words Iqui de Losh Odklonk doubtless belonged to a private language of the gods, which the Blemfroims no longer understood, but which, however, was still studied by a neighbouring people, the Edims, who maintain the ancient formal worship of Zeelkwoig Munzar and various related deities. The Blemfroims were indeed a practical race, and had few, if any, interests beyond the cultivation of a great variety of edible fungi, the breeding of large centipedal animals, and the propagation of their own species. The latter process, as revealed to Ibon and Morgi, was somewhat unusual. Though the Blemfroims were bisexual, only one female in a generation was chosen for reproductive duties, and this female, after growing to mammoth size on food prepared from a special fungus, became the mother of an entire new generation. When they had been well initiated into the life and customs of Vlor, the Hyperboreans were privileged to see the future national mother, called the Genquam, who had now attained the requisite proportions after years of scientific nourishment. She lived in an edifice that was necessarily larger than any of the other buildings in Vlor, and her sole activity was the consumption of immense quantities of food. The sorcerer and the inquisitor were impressed, even if not captivated, by the mountainous amplitude of her charms, and by their highly novel arrangement. They were told that the male parent, or parents, of the forthcoming generation had not yet been selected. The possession of separate heads by the Hyperboreans seemed to lend them a remarkable biologic interest in the eyes of their hosts. The Blemfroims, it was learned, had not always been headless, but had reached their present physical conformation through a slow course of evolution, in which the head of the archetypal Blemfroim had been merged by imperceptible degrees with the torso. But, unlike most peoples, they did not regard their current stage of development with unqualified complacency. Indeed, their headlessness was a source of national regret. They deplored the retrenchment of nature in this regard, and the arrival of Ibon and Morgi, who were looked upon as ideal exemplars of cephalic evolution, had served to quicken their eugenic sorrow. The sorcerer and the inquisitor, on their part, found life rather dull among the Blemfroims after the first feeling of exoticism had worn off. The diet was tiresome, for one thing, an endless succession of raw and boiled and roasted mushrooms, varied at rare intervals by the coarse and flabby meat of tame monsters. and this people, though they were always polite and respectful, did not seem to be greatly awed by the exhibitions of Hyperborean magic with which Ibon and Morgi favoured them, and their lamentable want of religious ardour made all evangelistic endeavour a thankless task, and, being fundamentally unimaginative, they were not even duly impressed by the fact that their visitors had come from a remote, ultra-Cycronosian world. "I feel," said Ibon to Morgi one day, "that the god was sadly mistaken in deigning to send this people a message of any sort." It was very soon after this that a large committee of the Blemfroims waited upon Ibon and Morgi, and informed them that, after long consideration, they had been selected as the fathers of the next generation, and were to be married forthwith to the tribal mother, in the hope that a well-headed race of Blemfroims would result from the union. Ibon and Morgi were quite overcome by the proposed eugenic honour. Thinking of the mountainous female they had seen, Morgi was prone to remember his sacerdotal vows of celibacy, and Ibon was eager to take similar vows upon himself without delay. The Inquisitor, indeed, was so overwhelmed as to be rendered almost speechless. But with rare presence of mind, the sorcerer temporized by making a few queries anent the legal and social status which would be enjoyed by Morgi and himself as the husbands of the Genquam. And the naive Blemfroims told him that this would be a matter of brief concern, that after completing their marital duties, the husbands were always served to the national mother in the form of ragouts and other culinary preparations. The Hyperboreans tried to conceal from their hosts the reluctance with which they both regarded the coming honour in all its stages. Being as usual a master of diplomatics, Ibon went so far as to make a formal acceptance on behalf of himself and his companion. But when the delegation of Blemfroims had departed, he said to Morgi, "I am more than ever convinced that the god was mistaken. We must leave the city of Vlor with all feasible dispatch, and continue our journey till we find a people who are worthier to receive his communication." Apparently, it had never occurred to the simple and patriotic Blemfroims that the fathering of their next national litter was a privilege that anyone would dream of rejecting. Ibon and Morgi were subjected to no manner of duress or constraint, and their movements were not even watched. It was an easy matter to leave the house in which they had been domiciled, when the rumbling snores of their hosts were ascending to the great ring of Cycronosian moons, and to follow the highway that led from Vlor toward the country of the Edims. The road before them was well marked, and the ring light was almost as clear and brilliant as full day. They travelled a long distance through the diversified and always unique scenery which it served to illumine, before the rising of the sun, and the consequent discovery of their departure by the Blemfroims. These single-minded bipeds, it is likely, were too sorely perplexed and dumbfounded by the loss of the guests whom they had chosen as future progenitors to even think of following them. The land of the Edims, as indicated on an earlier occasion by the Blemfroims, was many leagues away, and tracts of ashen deserts, of mineral cacti, of fungoid forests and high mountains intervened. The boundary of the Blemfroims, marked by a crude sculpturesque representation of the tribal mother beside the way, was passed by the travellers before dawn. And during the following day, they journeyed among more than one of those unusual races who diversify so widely the population of Saturn. They saw the gibbous, that apterous and stylitian bird people who roost on their individual dolomites for years at a time, and meditate upon the cosmos, uttering to each other at long intervals the mystic syllables yop, yeep, and yoop, which are said to express an unfathomed range of esoteric thought. And they met those flibbertigibbet pygmies, the epics, who hollow out their homes in the trunks of certain large fungi, and are always having to hunt new habitations because the old ones crumble into powder in a few days. and they heard the underground croaking of that mysterious people, the Galongs, who dread not only the sunlight, but also the ringlight, and who have never yet been seen by any of the surface dwellers. By sunset, however, Ibon and Morgi had crossed the domains of all the aforementioned races, and had even climbed the lower scarps of those mountains which still divided them from the land of the Edims. Here, on a sheltered ledge, their weariness impelled them to halt, and since they had now ceased to dread pursuit from the Blemfroims, they wrapped themselves more tightly in their mantles against the cold, after a meagre supper of raw mushrooms, and fell asleep. Their slumber was disturbed by a series of cacodemoniacal dreams, in which they both thought they had been recaptured by the Blemfroims, and were forced to espouse the Genquam. They awoke shortly before dawn, from visions whose details were excruciatingly vivid, and were more than ready to resume their ascent of the mountains. The slopes and cliffs above them were desolate enough to have deterred any travellers of inferior hardihood or less cogent fears. The tall woods of fungi dwindled ere long to tiny growths, and soon they lessened to forms that were no bigger than lichens, and after these there was nothing but black and naked stone. The wiry and slender Ibon suffered no great inconvenience from the climb, but Morgi, with his sacerdotal girth and bulk, was soon winded. Whenever he paused to recover his breath, Ibon would say to him, "Think of the National Mother," and Morgi would climb the next acclivity like an agile but somewhat asthmatic mountain sheep. They came at noon to a pinnacle-guarded pass from which they could look down on the country of the Edims. They saw that it was a broad and fertile realm, with woods of mammoth mushrooms and other thallophytes that excelled in size and number those of any other region they had yet traversed. Even the mountain slopes were more fruitful on this side, for Ibon and Morgi had not descended far when they entered a grove of enormous puffballs and toadstools. They were admiring the magnitude and variety of these growths when they heard a thunderous noise on the mountains above them. The noise drew nearer, gathering to itself the roar of new thunders. Ibon would have prayed to Zothaqua, and Morgi would have supplicated the goddess Yanda, but unfortunately there was no time. They were caught in a mighty mass of rolling puffballs and toppling toadstools overthrown by the huge avalanche that had started on the heights above, and borne with increasing momentum with vertiginous speed and tumult amid an ever-growing heap of shattered fungi, they finished their descent of the mountain in less than a minute. Endeavouring to extricate themselves from the pile of thallophytic debris in which they were buried, Ibon and Morgi noticed that there still seemed to be a good deal of noise, even though the avalanche had stopped. Also, there were other movements and heavings than their own in the pile. When they had managed to get their necks and shoulders clear, they discovered that the commotion was being made by certain people who differed from their late hosts, the Blemfroims, and that they possessed rudimentary heads. These people were some of the Edims, on one of whose towns the avalanche had descended. Roofs and towers were beginning to emerge from the mass of boulders and puffballs, and just in front of the Hyperboreans there was a large temple-like edifice, from whose blocked-up door a multitude of the Edims had now tunnelled their way. At sight of Ibon and Morgi, they suspended their labours, and the sorcerer, who had freed himself and had made sure that all his bones and members were intact, now took the opportunity to address them. "Hearken," he said with great importance. "I have come to bring you a message from the god Zeal-Quoig-Munzar. I have borne it faithfully on ways beset with many hazards and perils. In the god's own divine language, it runs thus: Ikwi de losh od klonk." Since he spoke in the dialect of the Blemfroims, which differed somewhat from their own, it is doubtful if the Edims altogether understood the first part of his utterance. But Zeal-Quoig-Munzar was their tutelary deity, and they knew the language of the gods. At the words Iqui de Losh Odklonk, there was a most remarkable resumption and increase of activity, a ceaseless running to and fro on the part of the Edims, a shouting of guttural orders, and a recrudescence of new heads and limbs from the avalanche. Those who had issued from the temple re-entered it, and came out once more carrying a huge image of Zilquoig Manzar, some smaller icons of lesser, though allied deities, and a very ancient-looking idol which both Ibon and Morgi recognized as having a resemblance to Zothaqua. Others of the Edims brought their household goods and furniture forth from the dwellings, and, signing the Hyperboreans to accompany them, the whole populace began to evacuate the town. Ibon and Morgi were much mystified, and it was not until a new town had been built on the fungus-wooded plain at the distance of a full day's march, and they themselves had been installed among the priests of the new temple, that they learned the reason of it all, and the meaning of Iqui de Losh Odklonk. These words meant merely, "Be on your way," and the god had addressed them to Ibon as a dismissal. But the coincidental coming of the avalanche and of Ibon and Morgi with this purported message from the god had been taken by the Edims as a divine injunction to remove themselves and their goods from their present location. Thus the wholesale exodus of people with their idols and domestic belongings. The new town was called Gulump, after the one that the avalanche had buried. Here, for the remainder of their days, Ibon and Morgi were held in much honour, and their coming with the message Iqui de Losh Odklonk was deemed a fortunate thing, since there were no more avalanches to threaten the security of Gulump in its new situation remote from the mountains. The Hyperboreans shared the increment of civic affluence and well-being resultant from this security. There was no national mother among the Edims, who propagated themselves in a far more general manner than the Blemfroims. So existence was quite safe and tranquil. Ibon, at least, was really in his element, for the news which he brought of Zothaqua, who was still worshipped in this region of Sycronosh, had enabled him to set up as a sort of minor prophet, even apart from the renown which he enjoyed as the bearer of the divine message and as the founder of the new town of Gulump. Morgi, however, was not entirely happy. Though the Edims were religious, they did not carry their devotional fervour to the point of bigotry or intolerance, so it was quite impossible to start an inquisition among them. But still there were compensations. The fungus wine of the Edims was potent, though evil-tasting, and there were females of a sort, if one were not too squeamish. Consequently, Morgi and Ibon both settled down to an ecclesiastic regimen which, after all, was not so radically different from that of Muthulan or any other place on the planet of their birth. Such were the various adventures, and such was the final lot of this redoubtable pair in Sycronosh. But in Ibon's Tower of Black Gneiss on that headland of the Northern Sea in Muthulan, the underlings of Morgi waited for days, neither wishing to follow the High Priest through the magic panel, nor daring to leave in disobedience of his orders. At length they were recalled by a special dispensation from the Hierophant, who had been chosen as Morgi's temporary successor. But the result of the whole affair was highly regrettable from the standpoint of the hierarchy of Yonder. It was universally believed that Ibon had not only escaped by virtue of the powerful magic he had learned from Zothaqua, but had made away with Morgi into the bargain. As a consequence of this belief, the faith of Yonder declined, and there was a widespread revival of the dark worship of Zothaqua throughout Muthulan in the last centuries before the onset of the Great Ice Age. Hello, ladies and gents. Ian here. Be sure to pop on over to our YouTube channel or Facebook page for regular updates. If you'd like to support our work, please consider taking a look at our Patreon or Bandcamp pages, or search for us on Audible. You'll find links to everything on our website, horrorbabble.com/links.